I get the icon in cornflower? Blue flower.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 5 of the Can I Get That Software in Blue podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Chad Tindall, and along with me is my esteemed co-host, Steve Mazak.
Hey, everybody.
We're joined also by our guest, Doug Hanna, who's the COO of Grafana Labs, the company behind the leading open source projects Grafana and Loki, and the creator of the first open source and composable observability platform. Under his leadership, the last 2 years, the company has grown from 70 people to 400 people. Prior to Grafana Labs, he spent 4 years at Zendesk as VP of Operations, and he was also the founder and CEO of Help.com, a customer service software company. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Just to start us off, Doug, can you tell us about Grafana, the company, and what your role of COO is responsible for there?
Grafana Labs is the company behind Grafana, the open source project, which is the leading dashboarding visualization tool, particularly for time series metrics. We have about 750,000 active instances of Grafana in the wild today, and it's used by everyone from some of the biggest companies in the world to nonprofits and governments to beekeepers and hobbyists. So really wide variety of use cases. The company is, as you mentioned, about 400 people. We're completely globally distributed. It's been really exciting about 2 years that I've been there.
And how do you differentiate yourselves from some of the other products in the space like Splunk or Elastic?
Grafana on the visualization side, I think, is really unique in that we let people visualize data from any number of sources, including both of those providers, and get that kind of elusive single pane of glass or as close to it as possible. And we're truly neutral in how we approach that. So if you want to use Splunk to visualize logs and Prometheus for your other data, that's totally fine and is supported. We also have other offerings that really are about helping people run the various technologies, whether it's Grafana or Prometheus or log solution Loki at scale and doing so kind of with the best performance possible. So that's where a lot of our differentiation kind of lies.
Is it fair to say the big differentiator there is that people leave their data where it is and you can still visualize it as opposed to the other platforms where you have to put the data into the platform to be able to see it?
Yeah, definitely. And if you're working across a large organization or company, kind of migrating all your data to a single place is probably never going to happen in practice. So we think that our approach is kind of both more practical and will allow you to kind of utilize best of breed wherever you want to do it.
What does the mix look like of people running your stuff on-premise or in their own environment versus running it as a SaaS solution?
I think on-premise, like what I would call a customer managed, where they're choosing probably to run it in their own kind of version of cloud infrastructure, just within their environment versus kind of as part of our managed service. And we're about 50-50 today, which is for a lot of open source companies at our size, probably more heavily weighted towards cloud than is typical. So we kind of started helping our customers adopt the cloud earlier than I think some of our open source peers have done.
There are various managed versions of this, right? Like I know AWS has a managed platform. I don't know if there are others.
Yeah. So we did a first party partnership at Grafana with AWS and launched, I believe it's called Amazon Managed Service for Grafana. It's a little bit of a mouthful. So we did a first party partnership with them. Obviously, you can run it on our cloud service as well. And there might be some others coming down the road, but we're not quite ready to talk about those yet.
And what are your responsibilities as the COO there?
Yeah, I spend most of my time on our go-to-market, working with our go-to-market teams. So that includes sales, marketing, solutions engineering, our different ops teams, post-sales, like customer success and technical support, and then a number of our corporate functions. So kind of our rhythm of business, a lot of our metrics reporting, biz ops, and IT.
All right. So you got all of it, basically.
It's a lot. Our CEO and founder primarily manages product and engineering. And then that's kind of the other kind of big group in the company besides go-to-market.
All right. Well, we have a recurring segment on this show called the 10K Breakdown. And you wanted to talk about Salesforce today. So we're going to jump into the Salesforce 10K Breakdown, maybe talk about the company a little bit. I'm curious why you picked this company as the one that you wanted to break down.
I think Salesforce is super interesting as a company. We competed against them largely at Zendesk. And at Grafana, they're actually a customer of ours. So I'll try not to say anything too negative about them, given that. And I actually have very few negative things to say about them. And the reason I wanted to chat about them is obviously they were one of, if not the first kind of true SaaS company with their like no software sort of idea. And I think they've executed pretty well in growing to be what I think a $25 billion revenue company today, one of the biggest software companies out there, all B2B. And so I think there's a lot of very interesting things that they've done. And they've had an incredible story over the last, I guess, 20 something years.
It is an incredible story. I learned a lot reading through their 10K, researching for this episode. Just I'll throw out some numbers to sort of set the stage, and then Steve will take us in with his topics that he wants to talk about. They had $21 billion in revenue last year, and they've basically been adding an extra $4 billion in revenue every year for the last few years, which I guess means their growth is slowing down a little bit. I mean, adding $4 billion a year when you have $10 billion in revenue is certainly a lot more growth than adding it when you have $20 billion in revenue. So maybe that's why they're starting to do more large acquisitions like Slack and Tableau and others. 94% of their revenues come from subscription and support. They are profitable. They generated $4 billion in profit last year on that $21 billion revenue. They have about 56,000 employees, 60% in the USA and 40% outside. So that's just some little numbers there to get us started. Steve, why don't you take us away with your topics?
Yeah. So one thing I thought was interesting is that, you know, they have an investment arm, right, for their cash on hand, which most big companies do. And one of those investments really paid off for them. They invested in a company that went public last year, and I think it netted them like $1.3 billion in return. So pretty nice return for them. When I was looking at their financial results, basically it looks like for every single sales rep, when they, it takes them a dollar to earn two. So that's just rough math, like looking at the numbers. So, you spend a dollar on sales, you make two in return. And I'm wondering from your perspective as COO, like, how do you think about that? Is there a magic number that you're looking for, or is it just kind of set a baseline and continue to improve?
I think Salesforce is a big winner, by the way. Salesforce Ventures is a big winner with Snowflake. They were pretty early in Snowflake. They also invested in Auth0 and have done well. But Salesforce Ventures is probably one of, if not the most successful corporate venture arm out there. And it makes sense. And we'll probably talk about this in a little bit. Like, they have such visibility into a very, very robust ecosystem that I hope they leverage that well. They seem to, from an M&A and investment perspective, Salesforce is definitely best in class. The magic number conversation is interesting. I was reading some of their investor day report, and their cost to book is actually going up, but they're saying it's getting them higher quality, kind of larger enterprise customers because their churn and their expansion, their churn's going down, their expansion rates are going up. So they're like, we're paying a bit more, but we're getting better customers. They're maybe saturating their market a little bit, though they talk a lot about TAM potential and how they're growing it. But like Chad noted, their growth is slowing down. So I think as you see that, your cost of book tends to go up. But I think companies, depending on how they're capitalized, depending on what their growth ambitions are, definitely have a kind of a magic number in mind. The benchmark is like below one is ideal, and then kind of above one is okay. But you're having to maybe you're having to think about it a little bit more, have a lot of confidence in your lifetime value of your customers.
You know, it's interesting to me. They talk in the annual report about continuing to invest in the direct sales model and just keep hiring salespeople all over the world. And it's interesting to see that in juxtaposition with this idea of product-led growth, right? Like try to get the product to lead the growth and, not necessarily invest in sales as a kind of in parallel with everything else with revenue. How do you think about that? Like, is there a moment in time where you say, we should have this much kind of product-led growth versus this much field-sourced growth?
Yeah, I think Salesforce is like anti-PLG's cool kid for the most part. Clearly, they bought Slack, which has been product-led in most of its growth, but like basically all product-led growth companies eventually hire pretty large sales teams, as Slack has done too. I think that's because, like, if you think about their products, like they're not products that are organically adopted generally. They are investing a lot in SMB, so they're trying to capture people earlier. And we saw this at Zendesk too. Like, an agent at AT&T doesn't decide that they want Zendesk and they sign up. Like an engineer at AT&T might do with Grafana. Like, that's not how customer service software gets bought. It's very much a top-down thing. But if you can capture a company early in its history, the next, pick your cool startup, the next Grafana will start using Zendesk or Salesforce when they're 5 employees instead of switching to something else and then eventually getting there. So I think that's what product-led growth probably looks like for Salesforce. And then if they do additional acquisitions, if they build additional things where like Slack they're getting some inroads into that. But my takeaway from reading the 10K and the investor reports was they have this huge customer base. 77% of their revenue comes from expansion. Basically, they're just buying things and building things to put on a truck and cross sell to existing customers. Like, that is the Salesforce model. It's worked really well. And they have the best probably land and expand sales motion of just about any software company. But it's pretty clear to me in reading, like, that's their model. It's put more stuff. They call it the customer 360. But it's really just 360 degrees. Any way you turn, you're going to buy some more Salesforce stuff, which is how they think about it.
Yeah. I mean, it works. Like, it's working really well for them. I do think it's funny. They say that, you know, customer 360 company, it's such a broad term. It can account for any acquisition they ever make, right?
And
they
exactly.
It's like there always be a way to tie it back to the customer. But I think it's interesting as a salesperson, if I were selling into Salesforce, I would definitely orient my messaging when I'm talking about value propositions and things like that back to their customer rather than Salesforce itself. You know, and I think right now, for example, given the fact that, you know, Doug, you and I work at Grafana and we're selling observability software, uptime for Salesforce is paramount to trust. And they mentioned trust as like in the first or second paragraph.
I think it's one of their key values. They started trust.salesforce. Like, the public status page idea really started at Salesforce, is my understanding. Like, they've been pretty obsessed with that from a long time. And it's not just status.salesforce, it's trust.salesforce, because they view it as like we as Salesforce provide mission critical systems. They need to be online. It's all about customer trust in that sense. So I agree. I think that's a big thing for them. And I think they're a pretty, I've never worked there. I think they're a pretty customer driven company, and that matters a lot to them. So I can see that resonating too.
70% of the revenue comes from the US, 20 from EMEA and 10 from APJ. And so I think they do have a lot of potential to expand in EMEA and APJ. There's so much money in Japan, in Korea, in Australia, in China, especially. So I do think, you know, in order to keep this growth that they want to keep, they're going to have to hire more in EMEA and hire more in APJ for sure.
Yeah. And I saw that a disproportionate, like a larger percentage of their, I think, go-to-market headcount in particular is in markets outside of the US as opposed to in the US. So I thought that was interesting. They're clearly investing there. You don't really see any kind of US-based tech companies get beyond about 50% of revenue being outside of the US. If you think about like Microsoft, which is as internationalized as you can get with products like Windows and Office, it's about 50-50. Salesforce's number hasn't moved that much the last couple of years. I was looking at some of the historicals on the international number. I would also agree. I think they have lots of potential there, because I think some of these other countries and markets are a little behind on the adoption curve of cloud-based software.
One thing I learned reading the 10K, which I hadn't heard of, is last year they launched the solution called Hyperforce. So you can take the Salesforce stack and run it on other public cloud vendors instead of running it on Salesforce's infrastructure. That really is an interesting change. And I guess just one more proof point that there's just a lot of value in leveraging underlying cloud vendors, so you have more capacity for regional expansion instead of Salesforce having to go build out new data centers in all these other regions themselves. You could just run it in some new region in AWS, for example, and have the same software there and meet all of your data residency requirements and all of that.
Yeah. I put in my notes that I need to do more research on Hyperforce just because it's a fun name and I want to know more about what it actually does.
They do have a lot of fun names. You know, I was curious on the large acquisitions that they've made in the last couple of years. They obviously are focused on this customer 360. I mean, their stock ticker is CRM. And yet the stuff that they bought, like they bought Tableau for analytics, they bought Slack for communication. Neither one of those things really stands out as like a CRM type solution. Obviously, everybody needs the ability to run analytics reports and stuff like that. So that's cool that they have that technology now. But I don't think I see most people using Slack to talk to their customers. For example, it's always like an internal tool more than something that's a CRM type tool. So to me, it stands out as an acquisition that doesn't quite fit the mold.
Well, Salesforce has had Chatter for a long time, which has not been the best product experience. And I think it's a pretty natural extension for them to be able to build in these capabilities. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of kind of Slack for customer service or customer facing use cases. Like they've been pushing that as an independent company. And I imagine as part of Salesforce, like Service Cloud is going to be their biggest product in a couple of years. Like I think it's maybe it's already slightly larger than Sales Cloud, and it's going to be quite a bit larger than Sales Cloud in a couple of years, what their estimates are. I wouldn't be surprised to see a Slack kind of customer service option come out. I've always wondered when the Workday Salesforce kind of markets will converge a little bit, because they basically have very similar products, just for kind of one is internal, one is customer. And Workday is finance and employee stuff. Slack is, or not Slack, Salesforce is kind of customer stuff. And it's like a database front end with some reporting and other things. Like that's fundamentally what the products are. So I've always wondered like when those are going to converge and if they'll merge or if they'll compete with each other. Like I wouldn't be shocked to hear that Salesforce rolls out an HCM solution. And it would be pretty easy, I think, from a product perspective, relatively. Or if Workday rolled out a CRM, like they have finance and they have ERP and some of these other things. So I'm super curious to see what happens between those two companies.
Yeah, that's interesting to bring that up, because multiple times when I was reading the report, I got Oracle 2.0 or 3.0 vibes. Like, you know, Salesforce wants to be the full-stop shop for you, no matter what, financials, marketing, sales, e-commerce, you name it. So that's why I got to believe, I think that there's got to be a database as a service or something acquisition coming from them.
Salesforce probably doesn't want to be in the infrastructure business. Like they want to be in the software business, but it will be, it's way more lucrative to sell the UI on top of the database than the database itself. So it'll be interesting to see. I do think they'll also probably make a bigger push into kind of developers in general. They're kind of doing that a little bit with MuleSoft. They tried it many years ago now with Heroku, which my understanding is like the thing that everybody wishes like was they could still use and was better and more modern. So I think they still have some opportunity there, and they have a big development community.
Yeah. They mentioned they call them trailblazers. They said they have 2 million trailblazers today, and that makes up development and like full on partners. And I was thinking about this from a selling into Salesforce perspective, is like, what does that number mean for them? So they have 2 million today. If they turn that into 3 million in the course of 2-3 years, what would that mean for their business? And so if you're selling into Salesforce, that's another thing that you could grab on as like one of those key business metrics that you're trying to drive change on. And if you have a product that can help them reach a broader market or bring more people into the fold, both of those I think would be worth going after. And as part of like doing discovery on an account, one of the things I would ask them if I was talking to the right department is, what does it mean for your Trailblazers numbers to increase by 10%, 20%, 50%, whatever?
66% of their ARR comes from customers that spend over $1 million. So talking about like the non-product-led growth, like they're whale hunting and they're expanding customers into whales more so, given the almost 80% of their revenue customer expansion. But that was a surprising figure to me. That's a lot of big customers.
One of the topics that we talked about on a previous episode was the fact that some people are trying to automate more of the sales and procurement side of selling software, instead of having a large direct sales force. So I was curious what your thoughts are on that and how you see that evolving. Do you think there will be a future where companies don't need a large in-person sales force?
Probably not, because there's like this natural tension where organizations at a certain scale like kind of design procurement to make it difficult to buy software, not to make it easy. Like there's a balance there, of course, but there's certainly, like, you see it with product-led growth, like companies are, a lot of them are switching to that, but some things and many things are not going to be kind of great candidates for product-led growth. And you're going to need people to convince someone to write bigger checks than whatever, $50 on a credit card or $100 on a credit card. So I don't think it will go to zero, but we're definitely seeing like, and this is not new, but like a consumerization of enterprise software and making it easier for teams and people to get started. But at the same time, you have this like macro effect of additional security and compliance requirements happening all the time, and companies like wanting to save money. Like lots of companies spend a bunch of money through their like Amazon or their Google or Azure commits, and like for reasons that kind of perplex me, it kind of seems in a lot of companies it's like a a budget black hole. Like no one asked any questions. It's just like, this is the budget that we allocated to Amazon. And like, you can spend whatever you want within that, which is why companies are flooding the AWS marketplace, which makes sense for everybody. But eventually finance is going to catch on to that. And it's going to be like, hold on a second. Like, this is still money we're spending and we need to add additional controls and reviews here. So maybe short answer to question is there might be less relevance on sales, but I think it will be product-led growth probably that will reduce that. And every pretty much all product-led growth companies that are B2B eventually will layer on a sales team that will generate a pretty substantial piece of their bookings. The only companies that really like don't have sales teams are consumer companies. This is I think a pretty safe thing to say.
One thing that's always perplexed me is why the contract part of the sales process is so complex. Why isn't this stuff just standardized? Why isn't there just a standard software contract? Everybody uses it. I mean, other industries do this. There's a standard contract for buying real estate, right? In California, there's a standard contract. New York has a standard contract. And yeah, there's just some blanks and you come, it costs this much. And, you know, you fill in the various blanks, but it feels like every time there's a big deal, there's all these lawyers talking back and forth. And is it going to be on our paper? Is it going to be on your paper? We got to do all these red lines and it takes a long time. And sometimes that process even makes the whole deal fall apart. So I'm wondering, why is there any value to either company in doing that as opposed to there just being a standard process for it?
I am an enthusiastic agreement on that. I think it's pretty ridiculous. Again, I think it comes back to like, in some ways, company procurement processes are designed to make things complicated as opposed to make it easier to buy software. And that's certainly some of it. Like a lot of these companies have regulations and other requirements that maybe they have and they need to pass those down. But paper process in sales is awful and kills way more, certainly slows down way more deals than it should. I would love to see like a standard contract. And I think some of the cloud vendors are trying to do that and trying to standardize that. But these companies have lots of lawyers that work at them. And I'm sure they have compelling arguments for why a standard contract is not acceptable to them. So ultimately, I think it will take the business people really pushing and saying, hey, we need to simplify this and we need to make it easier to get the vendors we need on board instead of spending all this time doing it.
Yeah, I always wondered if it's just lawyers like protecting their jobs or something, because that's what it feels like sometimes. And why wouldn't CEOs be all on board with reducing the amount of legal expenses, you know?
Well, it's also like in like a selling concept, like in like a real estate transaction, I feel like the parties kind of have approximately equal leverage. Like it clearly varies depending on how hot or cold the real estate market is, but like the buyer and seller are kind of on roughly equal footing. Whereas like if you sell something at a small company to Apple, like Apple has so much advantage there and like they don't want a fair contract. Like they just want something that benefits them. They have whatever, almost $2 trillion market cap to justify that. So there's a power dynamics there that I think certainly matter.
One of the things that I noticed in this report, and I have to go back, there's probably some history here to go back through, but their risk factors were 23 pages. And I don't remember any other annual report having that long of a section for risk factors, although Salesforce has been in business for 2 decades now, I think. But anyways, I was wondering, like, they talk a lot about trust. And in the risk factors, right after COVID, their very first thing is security. Like their biggest risk factor is a security breach, which is totally obvious when you think about trust being their primary tenant.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, Doug, from your perspective as COO, when you're consuming software like Salesforce to run the business, where's your threshold for pain with regards to something that happens like a security breach at Salesforce? Like if they had a security breach, we found out some of our data got let out into the world. You know, is there like, oh, well, that has to happen 5 times? Or is it like a gut feel thing, you think, when you decide to start looking elsewhere? I'm just thinking about when you start to erode trust, what does that look like? And how do people vote with their dollars with another vendor?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. Like, there's probably a bunch of considerations, like how often does it happen? What was the magnitude of it? What's involved with switching? What will switching make it any better? Like, And I think most companies, and to my knowledge, like Salesforce has not really had any substantial security incidents, and hopefully they don't for them and their customers. I imagine they could have one or two even, and it'd probably be like, okay, because again, like, who are you going to go to? One of the strengths of the Salesforce model is I don't think they have a lot of, like Chad said, no one really migrates away. They only migrate to it generally, and it would be a huge hassle to change. So I think people would probably not just immediately dump Salesforce, but I don't know. You see something like SolarWinds in the news from a month or two ago. I think a lot of people dumped SolarWinds pretty fast because it was a very public, very high profile, very serious issue. It's not nearly as sticky as Salesforce. So,
yeah, to your point, people had different places they could go.
Yeah.
There were two risks that I read that stood out to me. One was, they say, a failure by us to expand our services beyond the CRM market. So they clearly do want to branch out beyond the CRM space, and it'll be interesting to see where they go, you know, besides Slack and these other things. But the other one is that they list social and ethical issues, including the use of AI in our offerings. And I'm really wondering what they mean by that as a risk. Like, is there a risk that because they use AI in their offerings that, I don't know, some government is going to come and say you can't use AI in software or something like that? Like, that would seem crazy. So I'm not sure what they really mean by this as a risk.
I think they're probably concerned, and I imagine we could read it, that like there could be some sort of societal rejection of AI, and that companies that use AI will be deemed evil, or maybe that's maybe an extreme interpretation of it. But they're certainly planning and banking a lot on AI being a critical piece of their infrastructure. So I think that's a risk for them. It says positions we take on social and ethical issues may be unpopular with some of our employees or with customers or potential customers.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there is some concern about AI in certain parts of society, AI drones and things like that. But I just can't imagine someone saying, oh, you used AI to, I don't know, figure out which customers to reach out to for a sales campaign or something like that as being something that society really gets mad about. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they also say in their report that they want to create a framework for ethical and humane use of technology. And I put in my notes, like, what does that even mean? And should a company like Salesforce be deciding this at a global level? Like, because is it really Salesforce, or is it just the leadership team? And in the leadership team, is it really just Mark Benioff? And so you have this question of, like, you know, companies trying to take their values out into the world and taking stances on certain things that maybe they shouldn't be taking stances on. And, you know, recently there's been a couple of emails published or letters published from other company CEOs trying to separate the professional world and the family world, and to the point where I can't remember if it was Shopify or some other company, but their CEO put out a note saying, like, this is not a family, this is a job, and there is a difference. And, you know,
Coinbase, maybe.
I think Coinbase might have done something similar. So I'm just wondering, like, Doug, from your perspective, is it important that companies, when they get to a certain size and a certain level of quote unquote influence, to take stands on social issues, or is it better to stay out of it?
I think regardless of what's right or wrong, I think Salesforce has been very kind of like, very pro social issue, and they've been very like involved in the community for basically since the company started. They have the 1-1-1 model with time and money. Benioff is a super public kind of political figure almost. He's given a bunch of money to causes. Like when there is some, I'm forgetting the specifics, but there is some like pretty anti-LGBT thing that Indiana did, and Benioff threatened to pull like all of their employees out of Indiana, which at the time was like thousands of people. So they're a company probably more than most, I think, really is very socially involved and politically involved. And Benioff is not shy about that at all. I think you could argue if that's right or wrong, but that's certainly for Salesforce what they do and where they are. So I generally admire it. And I think I appreciate that they have a position and a stance, but I also think, and I think it's called out in the risk section, not everybody agrees with that. And if they are trying to sell to every company and every geography and every market, like someone is gonna not like that, and that might cost them business. But I would think if you talk to Benioff, he'd probably be like, I don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's dangerous territory, but I'm so split on this because I love to see that they're donating to charities and making investments to, like, you know, close equality gaps and things like that. Like, I genuinely think that's the right thing to do. And I feel like it's a good use of the power that Mark Benioff has amassed, I guess, and the money with Salesforce. But at the same time, what if their opinions start to diverge so much from mine or yours or anybody's? And then it starts to get a little tricky, right? Because now they're starting to have so much power that they can influence legislation that they see as in their best interest. And that's the thing that scares me, is companies getting so much power and influence that, you know, their incentives start to align with the policies that they drive to get, you know, to make governmental change. And at some point, I think there's going to come a point at which we're like, maybe companies have a little too much power, a little too much influence. And you could argue today with campaign finance, how it's set up, they already do. But for them to take stands on their own and donate money, it's like, oh man, you know, and it's not really the will of the company. It's the will of the CEO, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it varies. Like, think about weapons companies and like the influence they have, or Chad mentioned like the lawyers doing job protection. Like, there's lots of lawyers that lobby for certain legislation that makes lawyers more valuable. Or I think Intuit is one of the biggest, who makes TurboTax, is one of the biggest funders against simplification of the tax code. Companies definitely will leverage the political system to further advance their needs. And yeah, sometimes I think that CEO just kind of philosophical driven, like, I'm Mark Benioff and I'm going to speak out against X, Y, and Z issue. Other times it's like, well, if we make TurboTax and that generates 2/3 of our revenue is into it, and the tax code suddenly is super easy and everybody gets a return automatically filed, like, that's an existential threat for them.
That's right. That's exactly right.
But we are starting to see companies like Facebook have an external oversight board for deciding on things like content moderation. But Salesforce, they say in their Office of Ethical and Humane Use that they created, that says we have this broad responsibility to society. We want to create technology that upholds the basic human rights of every individual. But they don't really say how they come down or how they even think about making decisions. Like, will we sell our software to an organization that violates basic human rights of individuals, for example? And I've never seen any really software company have some sort of overarching process for thinking about that question.
Well, you know, like, basic human rights, the definition is a moving target. It's not something that stays static. It's changed a lot in the last 2 centuries. So it's going to keep changing. And, you know, with everyone's access to technology and communication as it is now, you see how easy it is to sway public opinion and influence with Facebook and Twitter and things like that. I mean, we saw that with the American election, right?
Well, but there are somewhat universally recognized, I mean, the United Nations has a Declaration of Human Rights, for example. So let's say China is violating some UN declared human right, should Salesforce keep selling their software to them?
It's a good question, because like, the country of China may have its own political views, but that doesn't mean that the individuals in China, Chinese people, think like that, right? Just like, I don't think exactly like my CEO, I don't think exactly like my president. And I think that's great, but it's so much easier to just categorize China as bad, and therefore by proxy, all Chinese, you know, think the same way that their leaders do. And I just don't think that's the case.
Oh, no, I don't think that's the case at all. But I mean, China is out there this week arresting people who even talk about the Tiananmen Square massacre, you know, because here we are on the anniversary of it. And, you know, I feel like they are violating someone's human rights. You can't stand out there and tell people the truth about what happened. You're going to jail if you do.
Well, let's juxtaposition that with Germany, how they outlawed the swastika. They're also trying to erase something. And I think most everybody would agree.
They didn't outlaw the swastika. No. They didn't outlaw the swastika to erase it.
Well, because it's a stain on the history of Germany.
Like, right, but they still, but they teach every school children, like every kid in Germany that grows up, goes to school there, learns about what happened. And that's just not true about Tiananmen Square in China. It's the opposite.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah.
They're not trying to erase what they did. They're ashamed of it, and they they teach people like, don't ever do this again. So it's just not the same thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting off topic here.
Yeah, we're
but it's fun.
You moved off this continent anyway.
Well, but I mean, these types of questions I think are going to come up more and more in big tech companies.
Yep.
Like, you know, should you know, I remember people complaining about businesses doing, you know, business with the Border Patrol, for example, when all of that was going on under Trump.
Yeah.
And should we stop selling to the Border Patrol because they're violating human rights and all this stuff? And I would like to see tech companies come down with some sort of process for talking about this stuff and thinking about it. Cause I feel like they all just, we'll take it case by case. We're just going to not really talk about it that much. And
the other tricky part about it too, Chad, is like, once you decide to open source a piece of software, you've just made a decision. And part of that decision is anyone can use this software for whatever they want, good or evil. We cannot control it once we put it out into the wild. You can control it a little more when it's proprietary, but probably not much.
Absolutely. But you also don't have to have a business relationship with people using your software.
You know, that's a fine line that I've had to deal with too in my career. It's like, you know, on the sales engineering side, is some sales engineers every once in a while say, I don't really want to work with this account. It's like, okay, I understand where you're coming from. And for this one, I'll give you a pass. But at some point, this, you can't say, I can't work with this company for this reason, that company for that reason, that company for that reason. Because at some point, you're just being like, well, you're probably not in the right role. You know, if you have all these black and white stances on who you'll sell to and who you won't. And so, you know, at my former company, we had to come up with a policy. Is like, we will sell to anyone that is legally, we're legally allowed to sell to. That's the stand. And then we deal with personnel issues where if they're uncomfortable selling into the US federal government or another government in another country, for example, then we'll make personnel changes and try to get that right, the fit. But at some point, you just, there's only so much you can do.
So Doug, we had this question for you. How do you view operations differently for an open source company versus a proprietary software company? I mean, not just around these issues of ethical things, but specifically in terms of hiring for sales and SA roles, for example.
In terms of how the companies are structured and run, I don't think it's that different in a lot of ways. I think we have to do a lot of education on how the go-to-market motions for an open source company, especially one with a pretty robust community like Grafana, how those open source motions differ, or go-to-market motions rather, differ from that of a traditional proprietary software company. And I think it takes some time, even for really smart reps or SEs or marketers, to fully appreciate the nuances or even to appreciate them at all. Because most companies are proprietary software companies, and most companies, if you meet with someone and they're like, I love your software, I use it every day, et cetera, like that person's going to be a great customer for you, or they probably already are. And open source, that doesn't mean that's the case at all. It's definitely, education is required, and it's definitely different.
What are some of those nuances that you were mentioning?
Just because someone's a big fan of what you do does not mean that they're going to pay you. And they could love your software, but that doesn't mean they're going to pay you. If I was talking to someone, they're like, I love Zendesk, it has changed my business when I worked at Zendesk, like that person was a customer. They paid us money. That is not true at Grafana at all. And I think that takes a while for a salesperson or an SE to really get used to and understand the dynamics of that. That not everybody is going to be a fit to buy our commercial software. And in fact, probably like the vast majority will not be, and that's okay. So that's a big one. And then I think the other one, open source software, probably more than other software, it is adopted from the bottom up frequently and by developers and individuals and teams and people that use it at home and all these other things. It's not, we don't really have a top-down sale, and we get a lot of developers that I'm, or a lot of our account executives and other salespeople, they're like, can we get an intro to the CIO of X company? And like, maybe if they're a customer of ours or they're a late stage prospect, that makes sense. But in general, like that's not how our deals get done. So I think that's true at another software, other open source software companies as well. So that takes some getting used to. It's totally a motion that people get used to. And some of our most successful reps had no open source selling in their backgrounds before. Some did. So it's teachable, but I think it requires a little bit of adjustment.
What about in terms of SA background? I mean, other than looking for people who've worked in other open source companies and have that experience, is there anything else that you look for when hiring SAs for an open source company?
I think that's a better question for Steve than me.
Well, yeah, I mean, open source is important, but you can teach people that motion, right? And especially if they come from a development background, they have a lot more empathy for the person on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
So I do like to hire people that have developed software before, at least know how to code, or on the infrastructure side have gone through the pains of, like, you know, a 3 a.m. pager going off and having to fix things. That builds empathy very quickly for the people on the other side of the table. So I do look for that type of stuff in their background, but they don't have to have open source. And if you train them right in the beginning, it's typically a fairly easy transition for a sales engineer. I've seen the transition take longer for sales reps because they just don't have the background and the experience to understand the developer mindset as well. And they've probably never adopted an open source project and got a promotion based on that. So they don't appreciate how that motion works. And it takes longer for them to see it, to see the old ways of doing things fail, and eventually look around and say, okay, everyone else is doing this other motion. Maybe I should start trying it that way. And that's when real success starts to happen for sales reps in an open source company, in my opinion.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask Doug about from an operations point of view, I mean, there have been a lot of articles recently about employees who are quitting instead of giving up the ability to work from home. You know, some companies are starting to tell people they need to come in, or if they don't come in, their careers are going to stagnate and it's just not going to look good, and all this type of stuff. There's been some blowback against the managers for that. Snowflake decided to go fully remote and move their head office from California to Montana. I mean, even though they're keeping their office for employees to work in California if they want to. Twitter and Square decided early on to let people work from home permanently if they want to. They announced that pretty early on in the pandemic. So I'm just curious, what's your thoughts on this, Doug, in terms of should companies make people come back to the office?
So at Grafana, we're remote first fully, and we were pre-COVID and we will be post-COVID. So I'm probably biased in that we don't really care where you live. And we don't care if you go into an office or not, and we don't really have offices. Previous job, people, I went to the office 5 days a week for 4 years, and that was fine with me. But I think the norm now is not doing that, and I think companies that insist on that are kind of abnormal now, and that's going to be a challenge for them when they recruit and try and retain people. And I just think with the way the talent market is in tech, which is very favorable to employees. Like, if I work at wherever and I'm good, I'm going to be like, I'm going to move to wherever. Like, I'm going to have a lot of leverage as an employee, and they're almost certainly not going to fire me. And then there's a question of, okay, if these companies like Google or Square or Twitter get much more remote friendly, but like the executives stay in the Bay Area or they go into the office or something like that, does that put you at a disadvantage? And I don't know the answer to that yet. We'll see. Being a hybrid company where some people are in the office and some people are remote is kind of the toughest and worst of both worlds in some ways, because no one is on an equal, like everyone's on kind of a different level. So that's the biggest question mark I have. It's like, I am now 100% confident you don't have to live in the Bay Area to work in tech, which kind of 2 years ago is truer now than it is now by a lot. What I'm not 100% confident in is if you want to be like a senior executive at a tech company, is it beneficial to you living in the Bay Area? And my current answer is maybe, but it's probably not a must, whereas I think before it was.
I'm just surprised we haven't seen more companies embrace the, at least more large tech companies. I mean, Google is still saying most people are going to come in 1 to 3 days a week. Tim Cook just sent an email to Apple employees saying they, starting, I think, in September, they're going to need to start coming in 1 to 3 days a week. And I'm just surprised to see so few of them come out and say, yeah, just work from wherever you want. We don't care. Just get your job done.
I think more and more companies will. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if part of it for Apple and Google is they spent all this money on this office space and infrastructure, and they're like, we're going to use this thing, especially Apple with their new donut.
Yeah, they spent $5 billion on their office. Like, they probably want people to go sit in it, but they also kind of have a relatively old school, like, office, show your face in the office sort of culture. Google probably has a version of that too, but it's going to be a challenge for them because people are going to be like, I don't want to come in at all, probably because they're going to move.
Well, if they keep saying that you have to come in 1 to 3 days a week, it means that you still can't really move away.
Yeah, exactly.
Doug, I had a question for you about startup life and your experiences. So, you know, you've worked for some good companies and like gone through the ranks and, you know, building high scale companies, fast growth. What's like one of the lessons that was really hard learned for you? Or was there a moment in your career growth where you're like, I should have learned this sooner? And how that changed kind of how you worked going after you learned that lesson?
What I found as kind of being an entrepreneurial guy in a bigger company, which was Zendesk, I hate the phrase like slow down to speed up, but you need to make sure you're bringing people along with you on the journey as companies scale. Here's what we're trying to accomplish. And then if we kind of work backwards, like here's what it looks like. And especially like consensus-based companies or like that's a really important part of building those cross-functional kind of relationships and ultimately getting stuff done. So I think earlier in my career, I probably under-indexed on that cross-functional collaboration. And it was more just like bulldozer, get stuff done. And now that's a big part of what I do. And I try to kind of tell the people that work with me to spend a lot of time on that too. The bigger the company gets, the faster, the more it scales, like the more cross-functional it ends up being. And like that collaboration becomes really important.
I was just going to say, it's been interesting joining a company during COVID and like remote first. I'm used to working remote, but you know, you and I haven't met in person yet, but it's been kind of weird not meeting the people that you work with on a day-to-day basis. And there really is no replacement for in-person stuff. So I love this idea of, you know, being remote first, but then traveling, you know, and meeting people in person often. I think that's the right balance, at least for me.
I agree. And pre-COVID, like we didn't really have offices or things like that at Grafana, but we definitely traveled a lot and we got together a lot. I felt for a while I was seeing our sales leader like every other week for something like an offsite or a customer thing or something. Like we were seeing a lot of each other. And I think that's really beneficial to building rapport and relationships and getting to know people, answering critical questions like how tall are they? what does their back look like from the other side of the webcam? There's an open question for me of how business travel will resume in general. Like, will it be more? Will it be less? Will CFOs, after not approving any travel expenses for 18 months, be like, we didn't need this. Like, I'm just going to cut this budget. I think that's going to happen actually quite a bit.
I thought Elastic did this really well when you and I worked there, Steve, in terms of having this remote first idea. But then every 6 months, we'd have this technical all hands for sort of cross-functional work to get all of the, not just engineers, but trainers and consultants and SAs. And let's plan out what we're going to do for the next 6 months. And we go off and do that. And then we get back together in 6 months. And I thought that model was really just awesome. You know, take all the money that we save, not putting everybody in expensive offices. And then twice a year, we can all meet in somewhere fun, Amsterdam, Madrid, Prague, whatever.
Tahoe in the winter. Don't recommend that location, by the way, in the winter. Multiple 12-hour bus rides.
Difficult to get to.
Yeah. But I love that for all the reasons you mentioned, Chad, but also as a leader, one of the things I pride myself on is being able to build relationships with my team. And by having that bond, by meeting in person and being able to hang out and have dinner together, have breakfast together, have conversations you would never normally have on Zoom, that helps build loyalty and camaraderie. And that keeps the team together. And the more you can do that, the more efficient and effective you're going to be because you kind of know how each other thinks now. You start to trust each other more. I'm really waiting for that at Grafana. I can't wait. Doug, what was the last sales email that you opened and why did you open it?
I actually started the Slack channel called Good PG, I think. Great PG, sorry, not even Good PG. And I've posted a couple where if it's clear they've done their research, they've actually customized it a lot for me. And usually they're dropping customer kind of credibility points around like, oh, we work with this company that ideally is related to you, things like that. Like some of those I'll actually forward to people and recommend. And then, so for me, it's all about research.
The only one I've ever opened from an SDR that actually led to a deal, a real deal, was with Lupio. I think it was like his fourth or fifth email. He took a picture of himself with a whiteboard and it said, Steve, I'm not a robot, I'm a real person.
I got one of those too. I posted that in the channel. It says, Douglas, I'm not a robot. So
do we need to make an AI tool that generates those images?
It probably does, honestly.
Yeah, it probably does.
Yeah. All right, Doug, thanks for joining our podcast today. That was really great conversation, and it was nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to chat about Salesforce and tech and all these other topics.
Yeah, I think we've been getting a lot of great feedback from listeners who like the fact that this podcast is a mix of finance and tech and sales and news, and it kind of covers a lot of things that a lot of different people are interested in. So those of you who love this podcast, please do share it out with all of your friends. We are at Software and Blue on Twitter. Our website is softwareandblue.com. Please contact us if you have ideas for guests or show episodes. And we'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.